morning, Kansas City. Welcome to Capitalist Pigs. Every week we talk about what's hot in business, the markets, your money. And this will be no different this week. The show is sponsored by Butler, Lands, and Wagler, and it's produced every week by Mr. Martell Love. And Martell, I think first of all, we should tell people they can get a hold of us at thecapitalistpigs.com if you'd like to send us an email. But I think you and I are grieving today. I think it's safe to say a good chunk of the population is grieving the death of a guitar genius, Prince.
Yes, it is a sad day. I was a huge Prince fan. My mother was a huge Prince fan. I grew up on Prince, and it is sad to see a musical genius, you know, pass away like that.
It is, and I was actually telling DeJuan that I think, who produces Mike Ferguson's show, he and I were listening to some Prince, and told him, you know, my appreciation for funk probably can be traced back to many different places, but certainly one of those places is Prince. People don't realize just how funky the guy was.
Oh, yeah. And you know what I respect? I respect a man who can wear makeup and wear heels.
Yeah.
And the women just throw themselves at him.
You know, he is the only person.
The only person.
That could do that. You're exactly right.
I respect that.
Absolutely. And in fact, too, I don't think people realize either. And this might be myth. I don't even know if this is true. And you tell me if you have heard this, that someone once asked Eric Clapton, who is pretty much considered either one of or the greatest guitar players of all time.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody asked Eric Clapton, you know, what does it feel like to be the best guitar player on the planet? To which he responded, I don't know, ask Prince. Have you heard that?
I haven't, but that's good stuff.
I wonder if that's myth or true. I have heard it quoted before from sources I would normally believe, so I think it is true. And that should tell you exactly what kind of an accomplished musician this guy is. Not only that, but a songwriter, right? How many top, I think they say he had 5 number one hits in his lifetime. I'd like to know how many number one hits he has penned, or at least top 10 hits he has penned for other people.
Yes.
Because I think the list is a long one.
It is. We talked about that on Greg's show. There is a long list of...
Is
of
it?
Yes, that he wrote number one hits for.
Bangles, Walk
Bangles,
Like... Well,
yes.
I don't know if it was... Manic Monday, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, that was the one. And I'm thinking of Sheila E.
Yes.
From the early 80s had hits. Now, I don't know about number one, but she had hits. And I think he was the writing genius behind the scenes. So, sad day, Martell. Sad day. I guess I'm going to have to get over it. But I trust that in your vast catalog of music that you can use between segments today.
Absolutely.
We will be getting a fair dosage of one Prince. What was his name? His real name? Rogers something.
Nelson.
Nelson. Rogers Nelson. And maybe in the next segment, I'll tell you a story about talking to somebody who went to high school with Prince. So that's kind of an interesting story.
That was an interesting experience.
Yeah, I bet it was. Except that I really don't think very many people knew Prince in high school. I just don't think he was a very talkative type of guy.
Yeah, I bet he was a very quiet, mysterious type of guy.
Exactly. Not exactly showing up to the bonfires
before
football games.
Let's be honest. They probably thought he was the guy that was going to shoot up the school or something.
Yeah, they probably did. They probably asked for protection from Prince. All right, let's move on to markets, Martell. Do you recall last week we were talking about a big meeting that was going to go on in a place called Doha, Qatar, amongst the world's biggest oil producers? Do you recall that?
Yes.
And I said that I thought that if there was no deal, the price of oil would probably get sold off very, very quickly. If there was a deal, and by the way, the deal would be to either, it would be an agreement among countries like Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Russia, to either freeze or reduce the amount of oil they were producing. That's what the deal is, an agreement to freeze or cut oil production, which would help get rid of some of the supply glut. So if they got a deal, that should have been considered bullish for the price of oil. No deal should have been extremely bearish for the price of oil, because then everybody is just going to keep producing at their current levels, which have led to a remarkably large glut of oil on the global markets. You're down with that, right?
I am.
And this week, on Sunday night, right before I went to bed, I got a little email on my phone that said, no deal in Doha. And I thought, okay, tomorrow I wake up and the price of oil is going to be $3 or $4 less than where it was at the time, which I think was about $39. As we sit here today, oil is at 44.
Now, how did that happen?
That is a good question. I think, I'm almost sure that, well, initially oil did sell off. Oil did sell off down to, it didn't get down $3 or $4. It went down about 2.5 overnight on Sunday going into Monday morning. But by Monday morning, most of what was lost had been recovered. It didn't recover it on Monday, but by Tuesday it had. It was all about rumor, and it still is. In fact, on Wednesday, from the low to the high was a 7% move in one day. From the low to the high, 7% in the price of oil, all based on rumor and speculation that there is going to actually be a deal getting done soon. I think that, more than anything else, has put kind of a floor underneath just about every risk asset that's out there, because people are expecting now that the oil price is going to recover, and that would prevent a lot of pain coming from oil companies who, frankly, have taken it on the chin when it comes to their solvency.
Now, do I have to worry about my gas prices spiking?
I think you do. Spiking, I don't know. Going up, yes. Okay. I think you do. Isn't that uncool? Not only that, but it's not just the fact that oil prices are going up, Martel, but also don't forget that in the summer, by law, we are required to switch to a more expensive summer blend. I don't think everybody realizes that you do have to actually switch the type of unleaded gasoline that's sold once you get to the summer driving season.
I did not know that.
And that adds a couple of pennies to the price as well. So if you were holding out, as I was, for 30 and 40 cent per gallon gasoline, ain't going to happen.
Not happening?
Not going to happen. Heck, I would have been happy just to have seen sub $1 gas. Now, I know it was out there. I heard that there were places in Missouri that were selling gas for less than a buck.
I thought I was going to get my gas for a quarter, man.
Yeah. Yeah. What happened to that idea, that dream? In fact, there were people that I listened to that are fairly intelligent people that were calling for 50 cent oil. That didn't happen, right? Yeah, we're going to have to deal with gasoline prices at the very least. We're going to have to deal with them stabilizing. We might not have to deal with them going up very fast, but at the very least, they're going to have to stabilize. And I just saw oil prices in Missouri yesterday at about $2 a gallon, and that's the first time I've seen $2 in a long time. It's been under $2 for the better part of the year, for sure. I think actually they started to go down in December of 2015 below $2, so I could be mistaken on that. But at the very least, $2 gasoline is back. So that was probably the biggest story of the week in terms of markets or the economy, which, by the way, we will get more into here in a second. But, you know, if there was another market moving story, it was probably the press conference given by the European Central Bank's president, Mario Draghi, where he basically said, you know, this guy is a broken record. He basically said, we're going to do a whole lot of stuff down the road that's going to make everybody happy, but he refused to do anything in the here and now. So that also, I think, was kind of a disappointment for European markets, which weighed on our markets in the latter part of the week. So that, I guess, also could be factored in there. One other thing, and I don't think we're going to have time really to get into stocks too much this this show, but let me just say this, that I do think the sentiment going into, say, Wednesday night seemed to have changed regarding earnings. We've talked about profit on this show for the past 2 or 3 weeks, and it doesn't look very good, but sentiment seemed to have changed in this way. I think everybody agreed that first quarter profits for stocks here in the United States were going to be bad, and that might have already been baked into the cake. In fact, it might even be that really bad second quarter profits are already baked into the cake. But once you get into the third quarter and the fourth quarter, the way they look at earnings in the big banks, the analysts, the people that track stocks on Wall Street, is they compare the first quarter 2016 to the profit of first quarter 2014, or 15 rather. So you're just comparing this quarter's profit to a year ago, same quarter. And it looks like the third quarter of 2015 and the fourth quarter of 2015 were really bad, so that the third and fourth quarter 2016 should easily beat those numbers. And that's what a lot of stock investors, stock analysts, people that follow pundits are talking about, how Q1 and Q2, dismal earnings, dismal profits have already been baked into the cake, and we're looking forward to the third quarter and the fourth quarter, where, yeah, earnings may be a little less than enthralling, yet they will be better than the same quarters 2015. Don't know if I buy that story, because in the end, bad earnings are bad earnings. I don't care what you compare it to. If it's bad, it's bad. And regardless how low you set the hurdle. And in fact, that is a lot of how this game is played. Analysts set the bar very, very low for poorly performing stocks, and then they beat that very low estimate and come out smelling like a rose. That's kind of a short-term strategy. Doesn't really work longer term, because a really bad quarter is still a really bad quarter. And then you got Thursday and Friday, or actually Wednesday night and Thursday night, you got some really bad earnings, and it did actually affect stock prices. So I don't know that I really buy that argument, but certainly going into Thursday night, that seemed to be the story. Welcome back to Capitalist Pigs, where Martell and I are grieving the loss of Prince. We're also going to mix in a little U.S. economic data, which mixes, of course, like water and oil, probably. Yeah, not exactly what you want to talk about while listening to Prince, but we're going to do it anyway.
I thought they went hand in hand.
Yeah, right. You know, we are going to talk about oil, so we just need Prince to be the water, and we'll be spot on. All right, let's talk about, this was kind of a real estate week. We tend to bunch up real estate data into 1 week, but this week we're missing some of the real estate data, but we did get some, and we're going to start with what they call new residential construction, and this is the report that tells us about housing starts and housing permits. And in about 90% of this country, before you build anything, you have to get a permit to build on land. And that way, if you track these permits, you can get a pretty good idea of not only how much is it going to be built in the future, but what. Is it going to be single-family homes? Is it going to be apartment complexes? Is it going to be condos? What are we building? So permits are actually not only a leading indicator of starts, but they are a leading indicator of the entire economy, because building and construction is such a big part of the economy. When you can forecast what's going to happen with construction, you are going to be able to, in large part, forecast what's going on in the economy or what to expect. So we were expecting housing starts, and I say we, not me, analysts, were expecting housing starts to drop by 1% in March. And this is the data we got, March. So we were expecting starts to drop. But they didn't drop 1%. They dropped 9%. And we were expecting March building permits to go up by 3%, but they dropped by 8%. So all told, very disappointing. But if you look at, this was a horrible month. There's no way to really get around it. But a couple things. Number one, this data is very volatile. It would be nothing to follow up a down 8% month with a plus 10 next month. Okay, so number one, it's very volatile. Number two, it looks like a lot of the weakness is really coming from something that has supported these numbers for a while, that being multifamily or apartments. It looks like we're starting to actually see strength in single-family permits and single-family housing starts. So that actually is not a, I mean, the numbers are bad. But if you actually look at what's going on with single-family housing, it's probably not as bad a report as many might want to make it sound. And if you look at existing home sales, we got a little bit more sales in March than what was expected. The estimates were for an annual pace of sales of about 5.25 million. We got about 5.33 million pace, annual pace in sales. So that was a beat. And it was an increase over February, which saw a huge drop. So we're making up for some of what was lost in February with what was sold in March. So activity is not that bad. And in fact, if you look at what the big story with existing homes has been inventory. Inventories increased to just under 2 million homes. That's a four-month high. So we're starting to see some supply, which may actually help bring some of the median home sales numbers downward into affordability regions. We also got, every Wednesday actually is the petroleum status report that comes from the Energy Information Administration. And people have been following this very closely, and the reason is for supply. We're running out of storage for all of the oil supply that we have. So as Martell and I were talking about in the first segment, that Doha-Qatar meeting was a disappointment, but in a way, it didn't mean anything except maybe a one-day hiccup because there are rumors that a deal is going to get done. And in fact, I think a deal is going to have to get done. There is so much storage offshore in tankers that are, it's clogging up well-traveled ocean liner lanes. So it's all clogged with oil tankers, super tankers, holding oil until the day it can be sold at a higher price. So we've run out in a lot of places, not here in the U.S., but globally, we've run out of land storage, or it's become so scarce that it's too expensive, so we're storing oil offshore. I mean, this is a huge problem. So every week we look at these numbers to determine if the glut is increasing or if it's falling. And supply in the United States has continued to build. And this week was no different. We set another all-time high in the inventory of oil that we have. But on the other hand, which is much more bullish for oil prices, production of oil here in the U.S. has actually fallen now considerably. I think that this is an oil supply story, but part of that supply is how much we're producing. If you can bring down how much we're producing, you will likely at some point be able to start drawing on the inventory of oil here in the United States. So oil has seen some pretty high prices here lately, finished the week at a significant high level. All of that predicated, of course, on getting some kind of deal. It's kind of funny how easily oil traders can be manipulated just by floating a well-timed rumor about who will be attending the meeting and who's already on board. And that is all, of course, speculation. Most of the time, when you hear a rumor like that, it is almost immediately taken to the subject of the rumor, where they deny whatever bullish news is out there about a production cut agreement. So it's kind of funny to see how much how easy it is to manipulate that market with rumors. I don't think the same thing would happen in like the stock market or the bond market, but certainly it can happen in the oil market. Looking at the Philly Fed survey, this is our first glimpse at what's going on in manufacturing in the month of April. In fact, every month, it's the first indication that you look at for manufacturing, because this does actually reflect April activity. And analysts expected to see this survey drop from what was considered an expansionary 12.4 number, drop down. They wanted to see it drop down, or expecting to see it drop down to 9 in April. It actually dropped to negative 1.6, which is after last month, which was positive, the previous six were also negative. So that is 7 out of 8 months of negative numbers indicating recession. So everybody that thought that the manufacturing recession was over, and there were many of them over the past week to 10 days that stated exactly that, I think will have to rethink their thesis, at least as it relates to the Philadelphia Federal Reserve region. Wanted to get into the U.S. economy in a little bit more detail this week. We're going to start by focusing on two indicators of the health of the U.S. labor market. And the reason I want to start there is because of two things, really. Number one, I think it is fallacious to go around talking about how strong the U.S. labor market is, and you do hear that a lot from pundits who should know better. All they're regurgitating is what the headline is on a couple of different indicators. I think to get a better idea, you have to look at more than just the employment situation, unemployment rate, the employment situation, non-farm payrolls, and the jobless claims. And that's all they're really talking about. There are other ways to look at the labor market, but and we're going to get to what I think is the best one here in a second. But the second reason for wanting to start here is that jobless claims now, the weekly reading of how many people are filing for unemployment insurance compensation or benefits for the first time, initial claims for unemployment insurance benefits. That's what jobless claims are, and it comes out weekly. Those things are as low as they've been since 1973. And in 1973, there were our labor force itself was smaller. So this is a really stunning number. So if all you were to do is look at the labor market, or judge the labor market based on jobless claims, you'd come away thinking, gee, things have never been better for the worker here in the United States. And I don't know very many workers that would actually want to claim that in public. But that is what's being said by, again, people that should know better. I think a better view of the labor market would be the Fed's own labor market conditions index, which looks at 19 different measures of the labor market and its strength or lack thereof. The six-month average of this labor market conditions index has gone negative 9 months and 5 months prior to the last two recessions. In other words, in 2001, we went into recession in March. This labor market conditions index went negative 9 months prior to March of 2001. And the last recession started in December of 2007. The labor market conditions index went negative, or the 6 month average went negative, 5 months prior to December 2007. So this is kind of a leading indicator of the economy, something we probably ought to spend more time looking at that I really don't look at as much as I probably need to, but it did, the 6 month average of this index did go negative last month. Does that mean anything? Not yet. It's something well worth paying attention to, but I wouldn't put a whole lot into 1 month of negative. Now, if it continues for a number of months, it probably means something. Along the same lines, we used to talk about this quite a bit when we were coming out of a recession, we were going into one in October of 07. We noted that the temps, the number of people who are employed on a temporary or provisional basis, started to slack off, started to go down. And the reason you want to follow this particular indicator is because the temporary labor force is usually the first people to get let go as you approach a recession. And they're also usually the first type of employee hired as you come out of a recession. It kind of makes sense, doesn't it? You're not making that much of a commitment when you take on a temporary laborer, and certainly you can get around having to pay for benefits with these temps. So you do watch this, and it does look like we may have peaked in temporary employment a couple of months ago, and we've come down off of that peak, something that really since the beginning of the recovery, we haven't seen very many months where the number of temps goes down, let alone in a row. But we are seeing that right now. So another indication of the labor market not being as robust as maybe many people would have you believe. And if you're looking at just the state of things in general, we talk a lot about manufacturing. Business sales are at a three-year low, and this is businesses selling to businesses. We're at a three-year low there, and a lot of this stuff that we're talking about today, by the way, you can find a chart to help you visualize it at thecapitalistpigs.com, and I would urge you to go there, download the free report that we've got posted while you're there. Another thing that you want to take a look at along the lines of business sales is the inventory to sales ratio. When this number gets real high, it means that we've got way too much inventory relative to the amount of sales that we're currently seeing, and you get an inventory build. What happens when inventories get too high? Well, you stop producing, number one, and that is GDP. GDP is production in the economy, gross domestic product. It's production. So your economy is going to grind to a halt if you just stopped production to get some of the inventories off the shelves. And the second thing you'd see is, of course, a fire sale on just about everything that's been stockpiling. So this has been really, really high lately. It's not surpassed the level of the last recession, but in a lot of cases, depending on what segment of the economy you're looking at, it has surpassed most of the previous recessions in terms of amplitude, its height. It is way too high, meaning inventories are way too high relative to the sales that we've got in our economy. The other thing I want to take a look at here is the Atlanta Fed does. They are probably have had more success in forecasting gross domestic product than just about anybody. And they've got first quarter GDP now at 0.3% for an annual growth rate, 0.3%. That is probably one of the lower yet positive numbers you can get, and it's also not high enough to support the type of economic growth that this country needs right now, When you're that low, also something to keep an eye on is that you may be surprised negatively and get an actual negative growth rate in GDP for quarter one, unless that turns around. And if you think about it, the first quarter of the year ended March 31st. So by the end of April, for the most part, you have gotten, I would say, 85 to 95% of the data you're going to get for the first quarter. You're still going to get some trail in, but for the most part, you're going to have a very good idea of what to expect by the end of April. And here we are with about a week left of April. We should have a pretty good idea of what to expect. And the Atlanta Fed is saying 1/3 of 1%, which, in case you were wondering, the long-term average for the United States is between 2.5% and 3%. Since 1980, though, it's about 2%. So 1/3 of 1% is terrible. And I think one of the reasons we are experiencing this sub-average growth rate in this recovery, something we've talked about quite a bit, is because we've just got too much debt. We've got debt in every sector of our economy, and it does act as a lodestone. We're going to talk more about why that is in the next segment. We talk about the business cycle and where we are in it. All I wanted to do in this segment is kind of set up the context for that conversation by saying, look, we're not expecting our economy to have performed very well in the first quarter, probably in large part, I think, due to an overhang of debt that just can't last. We're going to have to start growing faster than debt, or we're going to have to eliminate some debt. The business sector in this economy, the sector that sells to other businesses, is not doing very well. And in fact, they have been saddled with a level of inventory that they probably haven't seen in quite some time. And that's going to actually take away from future production. Not only that, but I also wanted to clarify exactly what's going on in our labor market. We see these low unemployment rates, but by no means should we believe that our labor market is as healthy as it's been in 35 years. That is seemingly absurd. And I think the Fed's Labor Market Conditions Index would confirm that suspicion. All right, let's continue our discussion about the business cycle. And again, just to state what by now should be the obvious, a lot of the stuff we talk about is maybe not better seen with charts or understood with charts, but they are there at thecapitalistpigs.com, that if you need some visual help in talking about all this stuff, feel free to go to thecapitalistpigs.com and check out some of the charts that are posted that are relevant exactly to what it is we're talking about today. As I have talked about probably too little on this show over the years, is that I am an adherent of a certain school of thought of economics called Austrian economics. Probably the only free market economics, I mean really free market economics. Of course, the school that Milton Friedman was a member of, the Chicago School, also free market. The only difference between him and Austrians, myself in particular, is that Milton Friedman did think that the Federal Reserve was necessary. He had ways that he drew up that would try to handcuff them from doing anything bad to the economy. Whereas I would just rather find a way to work around it. So Austrian economics, based on freedom, the freedom of people to behave in ways which, as long as it doesn't hurt anybody else, is okay. You know, do what you want to do, work where you want to work, produce what you want to produce without any interference. That's where you start. That's where the Austrian economist starts. And then you start adding in the interventions after that. For example, add a Federal Reserve. How does that change the way people behave? Or add in taxes. How does that change the way people behave? It is folly to assume that it does nothing to behavior, and that's part of the problem, I think, with some of the fiscal policy we've seen, some of the monetary policy. Whatever you do is going to have an impact. Probably short term, it will be a positive impact. Longer term, I doubt it, because it's an artificial restraint to the freedom of people behaving in an economic context. You are going to see repercussions. Now, the reason I got interested in Austrian economics, and by the way, that it's, they call it that because the people that founded this particular school of thought were from the country Austria. Ludwig von Mises, Friedrich Hayek, they were Austrians. So it's called the Austrian school, right? Well, they came up with a business cycle theory. We hear a lot of times people saying, Irving Fisher, I think, said it, that no one could have possibly have seen the Great Depression coming. Baloney. The Austrians saw it coming. Mises wrote about it. A lot of people say, well, we couldn't have possibly have seen the tech bubble and bust coming. Baloney. Austrians saw it coming. What about the Great Recession, 2007 to 2009? Even the Queen of England wanted to know, and when she was talking to a group of economists, why is it that none of you saw this coming? Well, Austrians saw it coming. So my interest in Austrian economics stems from the fact that they're one of the few schools of thought that understood our economy well enough to know these distortions were going to wreak havoc, and made the call, the appropriate call, the right call. Now, they would be the first to say that they can't predict anything to the day, the month, or even the year. But it is enough to know that the economy is undergoing a certain amount of stress right now. We have to be prepared for it, and that's the benefit of following Austrian business cycle theory. The theory hinges on simply this. If you create money out of thin air, bad things happen. And one of the bad things that happens when you create money out of thin air is that interest rates fall relative to where they would have been had you not created a bunch of money, because interest rates are the price of money. Increase the supply of money, see a fall in the price of money. Right. So the role of interest rates, by the way, is to equilibrate savings at the bank and investment done by businesses. And investment in this sense has nothing to do with stocks or bonds. It's investment in property, plant, equipment, and people. So that's the role of interest rates. Imagine all the nasty things that can and generally do happen when you tamper with the market rate of interest and you drive it below where it would be normally by just creating money. Well, that is the problem. That actually leads to an overinvestment in the wrong things and an underinvestment in the right things. Particularly, what it does is it drives money. When rates are that low, it drives money into production things, capital goods, for example. And you don't have enough people making consumer goods. You got people making production goods. And I've actually got a chart posted on this that I think is important, because what it shows is that after roughly 1978, you see this ratio of the amount of goods we produce to produce things versus the amount of goods we produce to consume gets out of whack. And it's out of whack because of printing money out of thin air. What happened in the early 70s that might have led to this? We got taken off the gold standard. We gave the Federal Reserve carte blanche to print what you want to print. We don't care. Just print it up. Print up as much money as you want, when you want, for whatever reason you want. What that does is it forces, not forces, but it's an incentive to actually invest in things that are very expensive, require financing, and have longer lives. And what that does is creates a huge distortion in this economy's structure. And that distortion ultimately does have to get rectified. And that rectification is called a recession. And I think that although we are at a point right now where we ought to be aware of the distortion, we're probably, you know, the Federal Reserve can keep the distortion going as long, probably longer than most people realize. And by the way, a great example of the distortion is all the money that went into the oil industry after the last recession when we cut interest rates to bare bones levels. Oh, the oil industry is one that does actually require, it's capital intensive, requires expensive machinery. And what's happened now since the price of oil has gone from 100 down to 40? You've seen a lot of poorly financed oil companies go bankrupt. Or maybe you haven't. Maybe you haven't seen it, but it has gone on. And in fact, a lot of the pain that the stock market and the bond market underwent December and January and February had to do with a fear that there was going to be a debt deflation, a debt sell-off emanating from the bond sector, the junk bond sector, that centered around energy companies that were poorly financed. That's a great example of malinvestment. We didn't need that much oil production. And yet, globally, everyone cut interest rates, and that's the exact type of industry that benefits from rates that are lower than where they would be normally. And now you've got a glut. That is malinvestment. Check out some of the charts that I've got posted at thecapitalistpigs.com that actually show where we're at in this cycle.